They don't want it bad enough. They claim they want it, but they really don't want it bad enough. They want it, but they're not willing to step out of their comfort zone. They want it, but they're not willing to change their morning routine. They want it, but they're not willing to change themselves, their identity. They're not willing to address their ego. They're not willing to look at their shadow. They say they want it. They tell me, Ryan, I want it so bad. I want to be rich. I want to be successful. And I know, you know, deep down, they really don't want it.
So Ryan, I'm really kind of curious about your whole story. There is some connection between what I've learned about you, about being a dad, about raising an autistic son, but also the company that you found, not founded, but purchased, sold, and bought again, sold again, I think, a couple different rounds, Visalus, because one of my friends actually did work for you. So when I saw that pop up my email, I'm like, I think I know who this person is. So let's take it there. For people who don't know who you are, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your story?
Well, my name is Ryan Blair. I'm an entrepreneur and I'm an author as well. I write about entrepreneurship. And, you know, since I was 19 years old, I set my sights on becoming an entrepreneur. And I started my career at around 20 years old, and I'm now 44 going on 45. So I've been doing this for about 25 years now. And prior to being a legal entrepreneur, I was an illegal entrepreneur. And I was involved in all kinds of street hustles and things like that as a result of living in poverty and being involved in a gang. So I have a pretty vast experience in the subject of entrepreneurship, both the illegal aspects of it and the legal aspects of it.
Now, as I track along your story, yours is quite interesting because you were living a middle, upper middle class family life, things that happened with your dad, and then you fell into poverty, and you've kind of been kind of going back and forth between those two states. For me, as a first generation immigrant, all I knew was poverty for a while until I got out of it and never returned. So I'm fascinated by this. When we have something to measure ourselves up against in terms of like how things used to be, you talk about the clothes and the accoutrements of just living an upper middle class life. And when you lose that, how do you process that as a teenager?
You know, it's a great question because just yesterday, as fate would have it, I was traveling back from one of my clients and I got rerouted. And next thing you know, I'm on my old childhood street when I lived in the middle class. And I told the driver, I said, let's go. I want to look at my old house that I grew up in. I lived in this house up until I was about 13 years old. And, you know, and I drove down the street. I looked at the nice yards. The people had boats in front of their houses. You know, there were kids riding around on their bikes. And I saw a bunch of kids, you know, traveling up and down the street, riding on their different dirt bikes and mountain bikes. And that was me. I lived in that middle-class environment. And when I pulled up to the house, it was really odd because for the first time, it really had sunk into me yesterday, like what I had lost. Because I went from this beautiful neighborhood, this beautiful environment, and the driver that I was with is a person I'm mentoring. And so he had come from poverty himself. And he was, you know, looking at how beautiful the neighborhood was. And he was commenting on like, what a beautiful environment that you lived in, this middle-class environment. But that was the outside. But on the inside, the amount of violence that happened in that house, the drugs that my parents did in that house, the fear that I had living in that house, the intimidation, the bullying, the loss, just the tragedy that happened in that house was devastating. And it was really ugly. And in fact, you know, I've had many nightmares about that house. So to pull up to it and take a look at it and to see how beautiful it was from this perspective that I now have today and to see how beautiful the neighborhood was an interesting deep dive into my past and my psychology around it. So to answer your question specifically, it was terrible to be raised in a certain way with a certain set of beliefs and values and an identity, and then have that identity ripped away from you at 13 years old. And when you're 13 years old, you know, you measure yourself by your peer group, by the way other people see you. by your teachers, by the authority figures in your life, by the sports teams you play on, by a lot of things. They are your identity because you have yet to form your own identity. You know, you're simply drawing from your environment and you're stashing away little elements of your identity left and right. And things that feel good when someone compliments you or you do good on a sports team or, you know, a girl likes you or, you know, you're popular in school. Those are the things that make you who you think you are. And then to have that all ripped away, you're no longer popular, you're no longer cool, you no longer dress well, you no longer have nice clothes, teachers no longer respect you. You're now bigoted because you're poor, you live in a bad neighborhood. And I told the person driving me, I said, I went from this neighborhood to a neighborhood where I walk outside and there's guys drinking 40 ounces, you know, smoking weed, getting high all day long. And the moment they see you, they want to rob you. I went from a neighborhood where you're riding, you know, bikes free with the kids at, you know, 10, 11, 12, and 13, riding around with free rein. My mom would tell me at 8 a.m., you know, just be back by dark, to a point where the moment you step foot outside your front door, you could face extreme violence. You're exposed to drugs, alcohol, and all kinds of evil, basically. And so it's funny you ask this question because I have, it's brand new territory that I've just, you know, ventured into as a result of yesterday's experience. But seeing that house was just, it was an interesting deep dive into what had happened to me in a way that I hadn't dived into there prior.
So what I'm getting from what you just told me was from the outside, the appearances would seem like this is the idyllic way to grow up and to figure out who you are in life. But you said like appearances are kind of deceptive because in that household while you're growing up, there was violence, there was drug abuse. And so when you went from one neighbor to the next, it seems like it's the same environment, just with a different exterior.
Without money, right?
Without money.
You really learn a lot about yourself when there's no money. You know, zero money. My mom was a homemaker. We had a pool in our backyard. You know, neighborhood kids would come over and want to play at the house because we had the pool table, a ping pong table, a nice pool in our backyard with a water slide and a diving board. And so, you know, I was a popular kid because I had all these neat things that people wanted to enjoy and experience. And then all of a sudden you're poor and people don't want to come to your house because you live in a very poor house. You know, your mom's miserable and she's suffering, you're suffering. So the exterior and the interior is a complete disaster. So I went from having a beautiful exterior and a terrible interior to having both a terrible interior and a terrible exterior.
Do you think those experiences, those challenges that you had growing up made you who you are? And what did you learn from that?
They did make me who I am, but they've also contributed to characteristics that I've had to work hard on changing. You know, when you rip the identity away from a young child, when you abuse a young child, when you bully a young child, when I was beaten pretty bad a number of times by my dad, and you know, I lived in a very difficult situation. When you do that to a kid, you know, you create some code, to use a, you know, a technological term, that isn't always the most efficient, most optimized, most harmonious code. And so I have had to pay a price for some of that code in my adult years. And I've spent a lot of time now, most recently, trying to reverse engineer some of those, you know, some of those beliefs that I had built and those misconceptions and those ways of being that weren't, you know, ways of my highest self. And, you know, so although it did give me a strategy that helped me elevate my socioeconomic status to a high degree above anywhere where I had ever dreamed of, and anywhere in that neighborhood. I could buy 100 of those houses in that neighborhood now. But with that came some real difficulty.
When you talk about growing up in an environment like that, it does change you, and there's things that you carry with you, some good, some not so good. Can you give us examples, some of that code that is something that you're like, you know, I wish I didn't have or respond in this way?
Yes. Well, you know, I'll tell you, at first I adopted immediately to, you know, the gang environment, the poverty environment. And so on the good side, I learned to adapt, you know, because I had no choice but to. And on the bad side, you know, I then adapted to this environment, that environment. And I, you know, I was constantly seeking approval, status seeking, seeking popularity, caring a tremendous amount about what other people thought about me, seeking power in ways that were not, that, you know, that victimized others. Like I became a perpetrator when I lived, when I was in a gang. And so there is certainly a tremendous amount of bad that comes from putting a child through that type of experimentation, basically, for lack of better words. And then as I became successful, you know, I started drinking and doing drugs and partying. And, you know, I saw myself going exactly to where my parents had gone. And I never saw my father again after I was 13 as a result of drugs. And I lost my mother as a result of alcohol. So, you know, I paid a tremendous price for my own drugs and alcohol that I gotten involved in. But I also, you know, witnessed tremendous agony and pain as a result of drugs and alcohol.
So even though you grew up in that environment and you saw the destructive power of drugs and alcohol and violence, when you became successful, you started to exhibit the same behaviors. You were partying like an animal, I assume.
Yeah, I had an energy about me that would be best described as like a, my ex and I are friends, and she texted me and she said, "You used to be like a hurricane." Mm. And she gave me a great compliment that I was grounded. But I guess, and there's probably people that have known me throughout my journey, that, you know, I had this hurricane-like energy. And now I would say that I'm certainly more grounded as a result of the deep work and meditation and practices like that. But I always had an unstable energy to me, even in entrepreneurship. And the way I would try to stabilize that energy, which is a failed strategy, was through drugs and alcohol. Also, I had this insatiable desire to be loved and to be admired. And the easiest love and admiration comes from people doing drugs and alcohol along with you. And so I sought some fair weather friends, and I pursued experiences that were intensely pleasurable. And I think I became addicted to pleasure. And so it wasn't only drugs and alcohol, it was sex, drugs, alcohol, and that entire lifestyle that became, you know, truly appealing to me, because the amount of pleasure that I could receive from it, powered by my vast amounts of money and, you know, and notoriety and the other things that I had created, you know, turned into a very decadent life that I was living.
I want to dig into that a little bit deeper, but for a lot of people who aren't aware of your story, let's go back in time a little bit. I understand that you became the CEO of a company called Visalus. And when I was a younger person, I was like, how does one become a CEO of a company? Is there a school you go to study where that's your job? I'm curious how you became the CEO.
Well, my first entrepreneurial endeavor, I worked as an engineer at a company, and I convinced them to spin out a division of it that I was running at the time. I was the manager of their data center operations, and I convinced them to spin it out into an entity that I would be the founder of and I would run, and I'd provide the services of that data center to, you know, the community. And they agreed to do it, but they didn't agree to give me the title of CEO because I was too young and inexperienced. So they gave me the VP title. I was like VP of market research or something. And I hated that. I wanted to be the CEO. It was my soul's calling to be a CEO. So I left that company and started Sky Pipeline, where I was I bought it actually for $15,000, and I became the CEO of Sky Pipeline. I raised venture capital, and then I expanded that into an entity that, you know, still provides, you know, service to this day, and sold it in a $25 million deal when I was 24 years old. From there, after I exited Sky Pipeline, the Visalus opportunity came my way, and I first joined as the chief strategy officer, but I realized there was a real absence in you know, the existing CEO just wasn't a great CEO. It wasn't being run, you know, to the standard that I wanted to run it at. And so I, you know, told my co-founders that I was going to become the CEO. And it was an awkward thing because, you know, we were equal owners and equal partners, but all of a sudden I had taken a higher degree of authority in the title, although we were equal in terms of ownership and in terms of, you know, our desire to build this thing. And so that did, you know, it was an interesting thing. It created some conflict, and And it taught me a lot, and I gained a lot as a result of that experience. So there's no school for it. You just have to claim it, basically. And that's what I did. At first, they didn't want to give me the title. There was some resistance to it. And I remember at one point in time, I've never shared this publicly, I told them that, you know, it is my soul's calling to be a CEO, and I'm either going to be the CEO of this company or the CEO of another one, and that's your choice. So it's either me or go find somebody else to be the CEO. And at the time, the other two founders were not ready to be the CEO of the company. Later on, when I would exit, I handed the title of CEO off to my co-founder, Nick, and he became the CEO of Visalus late 2016, early 2017, he took over as CEO of the entity. But I ran it for 12 years, basically, as the CEO.
Somebody who's listening to this, who's like, wait, what just happened there? You were brought on as a chief strategy officer, and you also then invested in Visalus, so you're a part owner?
Yeah, I didn't invest. I brought in some capital. I lost after I exited Sky Pipeline. I blew all my money very quickly. I was partying, bottle service, and my credentials made me appear much more wealthy than I was. And I used that bait to suit a lot of fish and spent a lot of money on lavish trips and shopping sprees and things like that for a company that, you know, that was along for that ride. I'm not criticizing them whatsoever, because I completely created this persona and this identity to attract exactly what I was looking for, and I attracted it. And then, so when it came to the founding of Visalus, I'd gone to a very humble place, and I had made a decision that I was going to serve. And when they showed up, I saw it, you know, as a spiritual gift, basically, and I took advantage of it, and I aided them in acquiring the company. And through that process, I brought in capital. I helped raise capital for it. And as part of raising that capital, I secured my position as CEO and an equal owner in the company.
I see. You had mentioned it was like your life's calling to be the CEO of this company, but it didn't matter because you'll find it somewhere else. What is it about you, or what is it about the title that has meaning for you?
You know, I believe that some people are just born to do certain things. And I believe my soul came here to create through entrepreneurship. I have been an entrepreneur. Even when I was on the streets, I was an entrepreneur. Prior to that, I had lemonade stands and paper routes. It is in my soul to be an entrepreneur. Like, I believe this is the craft that I came here to learn and to understand. And to be a CEO and an entrepreneur requires a high degree of responsibility. It's a lot of stress. It is very difficult, requires growth, requires you to scale as your business scales. There's a lot in there. I didn't know it at the time, but now as you're, you know, pulling this out of me, there's just a lot in there when you choose to, you know, be a chief executive officer. And I was able to do so through the vehicle of Visalus at a very high level, because we eventually were acquired by a publicly traded company. And so I had to be the CEO of a publicly traded company, and I had to go through a very rigorous training process and development process by my board of directors and investors and Wall Street, for that matter, to learn a lot about the levels of being a CEO. And so I've played that game at a very high level. And, you know, I continue to iterate and innovate, you know, in that particular game, because, you know, there's many levels to it, and I've accomplished some pretty high level activity, but there's plenty more for me to do.
Just to follow up on that, I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't get the opportunity to become a CEO or become one and do it poorly. So can you go into a little bit more about what gave you the confidence that, I think you're still in your 20s here, that you can come in and run this big company with partners and investors and carry all that weight on your shoulders? What does one have to do to be successful at it? Because you also mentioned the previous CEO, from your perspective, wasn't doing a very good job. What weren't they doing well?
Well, so to answer your question, I, as the CEO of Sky Pipeline, I got my ass kicked nonstop by my investors. They were some of the most professional, sophisticated investors, and I didn't know anything about, you know, financial reporting, analysis, presenting strategy, making your numbers, setting your numbers. I was green. These poor guys, you know, they basically had a 21-year-old kid that knew nothing. I was straight out of a gang, so I had a lot of street smarts, a lot of fight in me, a huge ambition and desire, but I had no skill. I hadn't gone to business school. I went to business school for a little bit, but left to do this. But I, you know, wasn't credentialed, didn't have an MBA, had no real world experience in running a company. I did have some leadership experience prior to doing Sky Pipeline, and that I, you know, ran a data center, but it was a small operation. And so, you know, I was green. And so I really got beat up. And so when I went into, Visalis, I saw that they weren't running a high level business with a high standard of excellence in their operations by any means. Not from a financial standpoint, a legal standpoint, and a strategy standpoint, and some of the key, you know, areas that I was very knowledgeable in as a result of the very difficult experience that I'd gone through at Sky Pipeline, learning from some of the best. And they were intolerant of, you know, of my ignorance and amateur nature. So at Visalis, I'd made a decision to really turn pro. Back to your original question, you know, I just knew that I was to be the CEO of something, and that I had that capacity within me, and that I had to develop it somehow. And there's no better way to learn than to do. And so that's what I did. I think you asked another question about what gave me the conviction. And, you know, because I had been in a gang, and when you're in a gang, well, and I was a leader in the gang, so I had about 100 people working for me, and some of them were grown men. And you basically have to be afraid of people killing you, betraying you, hurting your family, ratting you out, getting arrested, going to jail. There's a lot of things that can happen to you when you're in a gang that you have to be very careful of. And every move you make has to be very calculated. And so that experience led me to, when I started becoming a legal entrepreneur, to realize that the attributes of a legal entrepreneur are far less risky than the attributes of an illegal entrepreneur. And the characteristics that, you know, that I had to develop and learn, the gap between being successful as a legal entrepreneur versus an illegal entrepreneur, was easy to learn. You know, because if I could learn how to survive on the streets, I could learn how to survive combating against MBAs and Ivy Leaguers that are just soft people. Like, I would show up to boardrooms and look at them, and I would be like, if you only knew what I could do to you, if we were left to our devices. And as I went through this journey, you know, I'd sit there many times and hear these people talk, and I would just, you know, in my head, I was thinking about, you know, how these people are very weak people, and they're not strong, and they don't know, you know, they might have the theory down, but they don't have the practice down. They have no idea what it takes to, you know, to be, you know, an entrepreneur that operates at a very high level. And so I had that deep confidence inside of me that I had a deep degree of street smarts and a high degree of survival skills that, you know, my opponents did not have.
When you shared that experience, it reminded me a little bit of something I heard Robert Kiyosaki say, where he was a helicopter pilot in the Vietnam War, where he says, like, bullets couldn't kill me. Wall Street's not going to kill me either. You can survive this. You can survive anything.
I was just going to say, I have been shot at, I have faced the flash of a muzzle and survived. And, you know, I know what it's like to have your heart drop and you think, this might be it. It's over. I'm dead. And I'm very spiritual. I've had times where I've been rescued by my guardian angel. No doubt. There's no way I could have got out alive. And I got out alive. And, you know, and so I have to tell you that knowing that, from a spiritual level, I didn't really have it figured out until now about the spiritual side of this, but I believe that I was being spiritually guided through, you know, all of these endeavors. Mm.
I've never been shot at, nor do I ever want to be in a position where I'm staring down the barrel of a gun. What did you learn about yourself in that moment where you think this could be it?
Well, like I said, I have a guardian angel for sure. And yeah, I must have a deep purpose on earth if I've been spared what has been the demise of many others. And I was spared prison. I was spared death and many other endings that would have been far worse than, you know, the pain and consequences that I did face for the actions that I took. So, you know, I learned about my higher power during those moments. And I didn't always live a spiritual life, and I didn't quite understand it until more recently. But in retrospect, looking back, I can see you know, the hand of God guiding me to learn through suffering and then to now be a teacher to help people get through the suffering of their own.
Time for a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Welcome back to our conversation.
It seems like you've gone through a process of adapting to your environment and reinventing yourself many times over. And so somebody's listening to this and I'm gonna ask the question for them or on their behalf, which is, how do you reinvent yourself and align yourself around your purpose? I've not been in a gang. I've not been shot at. I've not had to live this life. Can we distill some of the learnings from that life that seems pretty extreme to something that's more, say, more commonplace? What can we learn and extrapolate from your experience?
Well, one, like, there's a lot of people in the world. And so you can just decide you want to become a new person and get rid of all the old people and start over tomorrow. If you're looking at yourself in the mirror right now and you're like, all right, I want to become an artist. Great. You know, go out there and, you know, buy the paintbrush and the palette and get to work and, you know, and declare that you are now an artist. It's easier than you think. Now, once you make the decision, the hard work begins because you're going to face resistance. You're going to face resistance from your friends, from your lower self. You're going to face a ton of resistance when you make the declaration that you are going to step into a higher version of yourself and a new calling in your life. There's a lot of resistance that you'll face, and you have to fight back against that resistance each and every single day. And for the first year or so, it's painful. And then eventually you get better at it. You have new people show up into your life. You attract people to help you on your journey and you become this new person. So it's easier than you think to make the decision to do it. After you make that decision to do it, it's hard work. But at the other end of it, you will look back at it and you'll realize that, you know, the reward was far worth the risk, and that the 20 people that you left behind to go be a new person will attract 20 new people or even more that are even more pleasurable and exciting and inspiring to be around. And so when you get about a year into the reinvention, you will realize that you made the right decision. But for the first year, you got to be prepared to fight resistance each and every single day, every step of the way. I'm now 2 years into starting Altar Call and my reinvention to be of service through entrepreneurship and to lead with my spirituality. And I can tell you that it's like, it's a dream come true. And I look back at the past 2 years and realize, wow, I had to overcome a lot of resistance. At first, there was a ton of forces lined up against me. You know, for the first year, I had people, you know, trying to stop me. I had people trying to poison what I was doing. I had people laughing at me, saying I had become super religious, that I had hyper religious, they said. They said I'd overcorrected. I traded one addiction for another. There was a ton of that. And now those very same people that criticize me will say, wow, look at all the people you're helping. You know, and I've bumped into these people as fate would have it. And they're cheering me on now that they see me power through the resistance, not realizing that their role was to provide some resistance to me so that I could build some strength that I would then be able to apply, you know, to this day. So, you know, the resistance is going to come, and that's where, you know, the deep work, you know, comes in. And anytime you step into a new calling and you make a new declaration of the self, you're going to be met with opposition. And, you know, this is what I teach people, you know, to develop the fortitude to work through that opposition, basically.
I imagine that you've worked with lots of people and have touched a lot of lives. Have you noticed some theme that keeps people from making that first bold, big decision and taking their first step towards changing their lives? Because I struggle with this, right? Because there's an abundance of information out there, self-help books, videos, courses, workshops, things that you can do. But it's not because there's a shortage of this information. It's the shortage of the desire to actually take action to change your life. Have you found any kind of common themes with why people are stuck in that state of attachment and are resisting so much?
Yeah. You know, they have some opposition, and everyone has opposition. You know, and there's tremendous cultural opposition. There's tribal opposition, cultural opposition. You know, right now you are being fed nonsense by the news. Your attention is trying to be subverted onto Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and YouTube as we speak. Like, your soul might be like, every word Ryan is saying, I need to hear. And yet there's another voice saying, oh, tune out of this and tune into YouTube right now and tune out of this and go check your Instagram and go check your email, right? And so you have a constant force that is trying to distract you from doing the work. And you are alone in this fight. You have the most experienced sociologists, psychologists, neurologists, scientists galore that are working in think tanks at Facebook and Google and Twitter and a variety of others. And they're looking at you and they're saying, how can we get you away from your life's purpose? They literally are trying to figure out how to distract you so that they can sell your attention to an advertiser. And in order for you to be successful, you have to be able to control and focus your attention onto one thing for a long enough period of time until you get to a level of mastery. It's that simple for any profession, whether you want to be a pianist or you want to be an entrepreneur, you have to have focus and attention in order to do that. And these external things that are trying to steal and monetize your attention is literally theft. They're literally stealing your attention. They're using every psychological trick in the book to do so, every technical trick in the book to do so. They're studying you at length over, you know, 5,000 data points that you've voluntarily given them about you to try to figure out how to get you off of this podcast right now and onto a cat video or onto a self-help video that you think is going to be the thing that's going to change your life. So you are up against tremendous forces at work that you cannot see. There's spiritual forces at work. There's your lower self that's at work. There's the cultural forces at work. There's capitalism at work. There's, you know, your tribal group at work that wants you to go drink a beer with them and get high with them and not get high with them, get low with them, right? Because you're not really getting high, you're getting low. There's all these forces at work. And so the big theme that I have seen in the hundreds of people that I have mentored since I started, you know, Altar Call 2 years ago, is that people just don't know how to inoculate themselves against those forces. And then the second theme is they don't want it bad enough. They claim they want it, but they really don't want it bad enough. They want it, but they're not willing to step out of their comfort zone. They want it, but they're not willing to change their morning routine. They want it, but they're not willing to change their diet. They want it, but they're not willing to change how they work out or exercise. They want it, but they're not willing to change themselves, their identity. They're not willing to address their ego. They're not willing to look at their shadow. They say they want it. They tell me, Ryan, I want it so bad. I want to be rich. I want to be successful. And I know, truth down, you know, deep down, they really don't want it, because I wanted it. I wanted it so bad that I would change anything about me, including my name. I would change anything about me. I would change my identity. I would change the way I walked, the way I talked, the way I dressed, the way I spoke. I would change anything. That's how bad I wanted it. And when I started Altar Call, I went back to those roots and I said, you know, to my higher power, God, I said, I will change anything about me to be able to serve at my highest capacity. Because as an entrepreneur at Running by Sales, I was able to serve a lot of people, but I was never at my best. There was always a gap between what I could have been doing and what I was actually doing. And I was an amateur at Visalis. I was not a pro. Now, as an amateur, I created, you know, billions of dollars in sales. So I had some, you know, gifts and talents that I was able to play with as an amateur, but I never really went pro at Visalis. And when I made the declaration that I was going to become a new version of myself and starting Altar Call, I went all in and I burned the bridges, burned my old identity and said, I'm going pro and I'm starting new, brand new. And, you know, did the work basically. And people are just not willing to do the work. I tell people, you know, they'll come to me and they'll say, you know, this is what I want. This is what I'm going through. Here's the challenges I'm facing. Here's the obstacles. And, you know, just yesterday I was with the guy who has, you know, $100 million company. And I'm like, I'll give you the solution. You want to solve your problem? You have to get internal clarity before you can get external clarity. And the way you get internal clarity is you got to meditate each and every single day. And you got to do minimum of 30 minutes. That's it. It's that simple. 30 minutes a day, meditate. I guarantee you, the guy I talked to yesterday isn't going to do it. He just doesn't want it bad enough. He's not willing to make the changes. He'll hear me say it. He'll hear 100 other people say it, that internal, you know, external clarity comes from internal clarity. He's missing external clarity right now. Let's go get some internal clarity. He's not going to do it. So people know what to do. They just don't do it.
Do you think when they're seeking advice or help that they need to hear what they think the solution is going to be, and anything that doesn't sound like it, they're not going to do?
I think that people right now are guru shopping. They're looking for a little piece of my buddy Grant Cardone, a little piece of my buddy Tony Robbins, a little piece of my friend Gary Vaynerchuk, and they're trying to go guru shopping. And, you know, eventually they might see a pattern that pretty much every single one of us is saying the exact same thing. You know, we're just saying it our own different way through our own relative experience. And there's a few maybe, you know, areas of focus that each of us have in our work, but we're all pretty much getting down to the same exact thing. And, you know, and we're in the age right now of a million messengers, which is a beautiful thing. And so, you know, I think that maybe, you know, each of us in our own way are planting seeds in the lives of these people listening in right now. And over time, maybe those seeds will grow. But if you're not in the right environment, you don't have, you know, human beings are like plants. If you're not in the right environment, you know, you don't have the right sun, the right water, and the right soil, the plant's not going to grow. And so while people are, they're getting seeds from, you know, all these gurus that are out there, myself included, they're not in the right environment for those seeds to grow. And so they're just constantly filling themselves with more information that's basically going nowhere. It's like throwing seeds on the ground without doing the work to till the soil. It's not going to do anything. And so, you know, the age of the messenger is beautiful, and it's showing some patterns and some common themes among all of us. But it's also, you know, it's also creating a whole lot of people that have a great degree of input, but little degree of output.
Going back to the question about how one reinvents themselves, I think step one was to kind of silence the distractions, and they come in many forms. Some are technological, so you can just cut yourself off from the distractions. Some of them are cultural. Some of them can be related to you because they're pulling you into a different direction, preventing you from making that change. But the thing that was kind of intriguing to me, the thing that I have a question to you about, is you went through a lot of stuff. You went through the distraction phase yourself, with drugs and partying, chasing a lot of different things, but you emerge a stronger, more resilient person. I mean, could you imagine telling your younger self when you were 16, 17 in the gangs saying, hey, young Ryan, don't do this, do this other thing? I'm not sure you would have listened to yourself. So the question I'm asking is, does a person need to go through this arc, their own journey, to only then discover the hard way that that was the wrong path?
Yes. I tell people when they come to me and they talk about the pain they're in, I smile and I'm like, ooh, you got a better mentor than me right now, because your mentor is suffering. And suffering is one of the best mentors you could ever have. like suffering is the best teacher. There's no better teacher than suffering. I'm not nearly as good of a teacher as suffering is. I'm in a different college. Right now you're in the College of Suffering. And once you graduate from the College of Suffering, then we could talk about the College of the Light and, you know, the college that I'm a professor in. But I know the College of Suffering. I've been in that college. I graduated from it. Now I'm no longer need to be taught by suffering to the same degree that I used to. And we all learn from pain and suffering. That's part of the human condition. So to answer your question, you know, directly, it's like when I see a person that's still smoking weed, even though they want a great career and they have a lot of potential in them and they're not. When I see a person that, you know, is self-medicating when they know that self-medication isn't the way forward, you know, I just, you know, I smile and I say, you know, let me know when you're done with the teacher of suffering and then I can work with you. But until then, I love you. I embrace you. You're in for the ride of your life. And it's going to be, you know, you're going to learn a lot from it. And so I can't wait to compare notes with you once you've graduated from the school of suffering.
I like that sentiment a lot. Let me know when you're done with the teacher of suffering. It's empathetic. We're also saying like everybody's got to go through their own thing. And when you're ready, it's going to be this beautiful, wonderful thing. I'd love to accompany you and be a friend, a mentor, and a guide to this other place. So I guess people do have to go through their own, the dark night of the soul before they're ready to climb out, right?
Yeah. Well, you absolutely, well, if you want to be a hero, you're going to have to go through, you know, the darkest night. You're going to have to go through isolation. You're going to have to live in a cave for a while. You're going to have people attack you and crucify you. I mean, this is the formula that the universe uses to create heroes. And it's been the same formula for thousands of years. And every legend that we talk about has a very similar formula. So you're going to have to go through it. It's up to you as to how fast you want to go through it. So you're going to have to go through it. I had a student that lost his company because, you know, he had broken from his integrity and his values. And I was like, you're going into the wilderness. I love you. But you're going in. How long you're in the wilderness is up to you, right? I can't help you not go into the wilderness. You signed up for this class, right? I see you're going there. You're losing your company. It's going to fall apart. You're not going to pick it back up. You're not going to save it. The more you keep digging, the more painful it's going to be. Surrender and enter the wilderness. And then ask yourself, how long do I need to be in here? And the way you speed up the duration and get out of the wilderness quicker is, you know, you commit, you do the work, you work on the self, you go deep, you heal, you contemplate, you meditate, and, you know, you do the work every single day consecutively. And if you do that, you can grow yourself out of the wilderness. But there's only one way out of a hole, and that's to grow. So anytime that I've been in a hole, you know, I'm at rock bottom or I'm in a place I don't want to be, I have to increase my amount of growth to get out of it. What happens is people go into the wilderness and then they suffer from suffering. And this is an interesting distinction you got to be very careful about. See, it sucks when you lose your company. It sucks when you fail. It sucks when you get a divorce or you get cheated on or you get left. And then you suffer about the suffering. And that creates a loop. And that loop reprograms you and it actually shifts your state to more negativity in your life. And then you're going to stay in the wilderness even longer. So if you want to get out of the wilderness, if you want to get out of the hole, you got to stop suffering from suffering and you got to start growing. And the faster you grow, the faster you're going to get to the other side of that adventure.
Love it. You talked about being in the hole. In your timeline, in your story, you talk about your mom having an accident and finding out that she's in a coma while trying to launch this book, Nothing to Lose, Everything to Gain, and also learning that your son has autism. I think he was 2 years old at the time. That's a lot to be going through, highs, lows, and challenges. I want to talk a little bit because as I watch the documentary film that you're in, I see you getting choked up talking about your son and reflecting if it's somehow maybe punishment for you being, for failing, for not doing whatever it is you're supposed to do, the universe saying we're going to throw the toughest challenge at you, and also the importance that you put on being a better father to your own child than the one that you had.
Yeah.
So the reason why I want to talk to you a little bit about your autistic son, is I can see you trying to connect with them, trying to play with him, and he's just not responding to you. And my nephew, my younger brother's son is autistic. And it was like, as if he's not paying attention or he's angry or something is off. And it's just, we want to connect, especially to our own child. Tell me about the mindset that you're going through at that point, and then catch us up, get us up to speed as to what's happened since then.
Wow. Like that's a great question. It's deep, and you're going to get me to choke up now, because, you know, I didn't realize that that was what was on the film. You know, I was trying to connect with him, and I just wanted nothing more than to, you know, feel this love and give this love that I have within me. And I couldn't express my love the way I wanted to. And him having autism, he couldn't express his the way he wanted to either. So, you know, it was a very, very difficult time. I cried a lot. There were times where I had to restrain him from hurting himself for many hours of the day. Like, you know, one time I counted out of a 12-hour day, I'd been holding him back against himself for like 10 of the 12 hours, meaning, you know, trying to soothe him and stop him from scratching his face and hitting and banging his head against the wall and these, you know, very terrible, difficult situations that he was going through. I'll tell you that the pain that he was going through was far greater than the pain that I was going through, though. Although in the documentary, he was so young, I have to tell you that he was going through it. And, you know, by the result of the spiritual work that I have done, he has had a tremendous amount of healing. His mom and I have got him early help. We got him all kinds of therapy. We you know, we threw as much love at him as we possibly could. And as a result of how much love we gave toward him, and, you know, in the therapy and the spiritual work, he's no longer suffering from autism whatsoever. And I have the deepest connections with him. Literally, most nights, you know, he has his own room. He's 13 years old, but he no longer shows any signs of autism whatsoever. It is a true miracle that I have to give credit to God for. And, you know, my son had something inside of him that was stopping him, and it was tormenting him and torturing him. And that something left him. When my mother passed away, after she had awakened, also a miracle, from the coma, she had a few years where she was severely handicapped and in a very difficult state. Although I could talk to her, we could share some things. And there were some beautiful moments that occurred after she woke up from the coma. Very beautiful. It was still highly traumatic. And so I had, for 7 years, I had some severe family events. You know, my mother's coma, my stepfather and mentor passing away tragically in my arms, my son's autism. And all of those things happened as I became, you know, ultra successful, very wealthy, and had a significant amount of notoriety as a result of the success of my books and my companies. And so I had this wonderful duality, and that duality was like a pressure cooker. And to escape that duality, I, you know, turned to pleasure and decadence and self-medication and sex and drugs and a variety of other vices to try to escape that pressure cooker. And when my mother passed away, you know, basically for lack of better words, I would say I went nuclear. My company was failing at that point. I had this ultra toxic relationship with my son's mother, which we've healed and it's beautiful now, but it was bad. My son wasn't healthy and my mother was gone. And I looked myself in the mirror and I realized that I would have given any of those late nights partying, by late nights, those benders, you know, 5-day benders partying, I'd have given any of them back to have another moment with my mother. And so I was mad at myself. I was mad at those people that had taken my time away from my mother. I was mad at those people that had used guilt that, you know, to persuade me to work. And I was mad at the world. And I was most importantly mad at myself. And from that, though, I was able to strip the layers of darkness that I had accumulated and make it and get to the root of the light of where my soul was at and make a decision that I was going to make some changes in my life. And literally from that point forward, my whole life is changed to be blessed and filled with abundance and, you know, and a lot of deep healing and a lot of deep work. Mm.
Wow. I mean, that's a lot to process. I mean, I can only imagine dealing with one of those challenges, but all of them stacked together and simultaneously as your career was on some meteoric rise to the top, your personal life was just heading the same velocity in the exact opposite direction. It's a miracle you're still here and that didn't tear you apart. Cause I can feel like maybe that's like two forces quite literally pulling you one opposite directions.
Yeah, it is a miracle that I'm here. The only reason why I'm here, because I went through some really dark times during this whole process. The only reason why I'm here is because I love my son so much that I wasn't going to take my own life because I wouldn't do that to him. I knew that he needed a father. And I knew that I had to, you know, I went through a custody battle and I wasn't allowed to see him for 6 months. And so this is when my real reinvention was born. I said that I'm going to become such a different person. I'm going to shine so much light that there's not going to be a court or a judge or a lawyer that's going to stop me. That I'm going to get so, you know, heal and strip down, you know, everything that I possibly could. Because I didn't know for sure that I'd get him back. I didn't know that I could convince the judge or the attorneys or, you know, these things can take years and these things can be devastating to a father, particularly in the California court system. And so the strategy my attorneys laid out for me could be a multi-year process and it could be a disaster. And so I said, I'm not going to follow the advice of my attorneys. I'm going to get so deep into my spiritual and personal growth that there is no way that I can be stopped because the light that I will shine will be so bright that it will paint the sky blue and that my son will know that I'm, you know, that I'm the father that he needs and everyone else in the world will too. And so I had a level of conviction to do the healing work and to fix the things about me that had created this toxic situation that I was in because I was certainly responsible for my fair share of it. And, you know, when I did the work and got my son back and I've been doing the work ever since with the same level of commitment, you know, and with the same desire to now not just be the father to my son, but be the father to as many people as I possibly can in the entrepreneurial field. Mm.
You mentioned something in the film about the love that you give to the world is with conditions. There are strings attached. There's a caveat, but with your son, it's unconditional, meaning without strings. And I think about these things as a dad myself. I have two boys and that's the only people I would exchange my life for. Literally, yeah. I would exchange my life. If I could step in front of the train to save their life, I would do that. Yeah. And there's no one else that I would do that for. And to then try to pour your love and your energy and everything about you to heal yourself and to heal your child, and then to see this kind of miraculous transformation. I've never heard anybody say, my child is now autism free or no longer autistic. Like there's levels of autism, because also my nephew he's as far as any, most people can tell, he's a pretty adjusted kid. He doesn't have the same challenges because of the same help and attention and love. And it's quite wonderful to actually see this healing process happen. So do you feel like at a certain point in your life that your child is the thing that helps to keep you grounded, to make sure you have your priorities straight? Is that the thing that stopped you from being a hurricane to being grounded?
Yeah, he came here to teach me. I like to think spiritually, he was sitting there saying, all right, this is my exact time to come in to stop this guy from going off the rails. You know, and I'm going to come in and I'm going to come in with this illness and I'm going to come in with this to try to steer Ryan on course. So he teaches me as much as I teach him, that's for sure. And, you know, and that level of responsibility, when you do have a child with special needs, it heightens your level of responsibility. It also changes you. You have to adapt to them. You have to understand how they learn. And, you know, you can't just parent by default. You have to be a very active parent when you have a child with special needs. And so a child with special needs teaches you more about yourself than you could ever imagine. And it is a gift. It is a true gift. I've learned more from my son than from any other mentor that I've ever imagined. And my son is very gifted. So I actually go to him for counsel. You know, I'll talk to him about my business. I'll invite him into the numbers. I'll ask him, what do you think I should do here? And he'll give me some wisdom sometimes that I think is divinely appointed. And I take it. You know, there's been plenty of times where I've been seeking clarity, and I'll say, what would you do if you were me? And he'll give me the exact answer I need. And I'm like, all right, let's go. So I have the benefit of having a son that is a tremendous survivor of having overcome great difficulties. And he has some beautiful wisdom in him that he now shares with me. And I invite him to actually share that with some of my students as well.
So good. Okay. Many of us fantasize about making more money than we know what to do with. Like F you money, more money than God, as the expression goes.
Yeah.
You've actually achieved that. In 2012, you sold the company for $792 million. Now, I have to ask the question, why work? Why not be a philanthropist? Why not just enjoy the rest of your life and spend every moment with the people that you care about? What compels you to do the next thing?
Well, I am a philanthropist. The for-profit model is the very best way to affect change. I'm actually on the board of a nonprofit, and it's called National Angels. We support 3,000 foster kids, and I'm very familiar with the nonprofit model, and having donated to a lot of charities, you know, I'm very familiar with it. There's just no better way to affect change than the for-profit model. So this is the way that I'm affecting change. And right now in our company, we're innovating on technology that, you know, is going to revolutionize the coaching space. And we're deep diving into various psychology and research studies. And, you know, it's the time of my life when it comes to innovation, experimentation, and growth. There's no better way to grow than an entrepreneurial vehicle. It's going to test you. And even though I had experience and success in the past, starting, you know, a brand new company means you got to start over. And so I can grow through things much easier this time around because I've already built a house. And so now I know how to build one. So I'm building it much more efficiently, and I'm able to weather some storms and build the house in preparation for those storms in ways that I didn't know to do before. But nonetheless, there's no greater adventure than to create a company and to see that company make an impact in the world, and to have a company and a team of people that are aligned in values, and, you know, and to grow as they grow, I grow, and so forth. So there's nothing more exhilarating and adventurous than building and growing a company. It's the time of my life right now. I did try to not work. I took 2 years off, and I did nothing for 2 years. I resigned from all boards. I liquidated all investments. I had zero. I sold homes. I reduced, you know, I had a fleet of cars. I had a bunch of homes. I had a jet. I had, you know, all kinds of things that I collected. It was like all kinds of stuff. And all that stuff had owned me. And it had actually stopped me from being creative. Because the way my mind worked, I spent more time thinking about protecting and insuring my stuff and collecting more stuff than I did in actually creating. And so as I had gotten to that level of wealth, you know, I did what I thought I should do, which is, you know, buy art and, you know, and do this and do that and buy homes and, you know, live in luxury. And I realized that all of that had stunted my creative growth. And so during the 2 years, I went down to zero. Not financially, because I, you know, still had wealth, but I went down to zero in terms of the work that I did. I went down in terms of zero in terms of, you know, spending money and collecting stuff and consumerism. I wore gym clothes every day. I didn't care about, you know, $20,000 coats and $100,000 watches and all those things that I had cared about. And I said, all of that stuff, you know, it was great. It was an experience. I'm going to focus on getting to the roots of my creativity. And so I went down to a place where, you know, I zeroed out everything, and I spent 2 years doing nothing but connecting to nature, my spirituality, my son, and myself. And after a period of time, I realized that I was now suffering again. You can do that, you know, that amount of work because there's something in it for you. But after you get to a level of healing, you can't spend the rest of your life in tranquility and seeking tranquility, particularly if your soul is here to, you know, to make an impact and to inspire and contribute to making some change in the world. And so eventually I realized, wow, I'm suffering again after 2 years. And it was my son who told me, he says, Dad, you need to get a job again. I was like, what do you mean I need to get a job? And he's like, he says, you're not happy and you're bored and you need something. And I'm like, well, what should I do? And I gave him a piece of paper and a pen, and he drew a hospital. And he said, in this hospital, you're going to have a healing center, because I had like sound bowls and I was meditating and I had all these healing things going on in my house. And he designed out this hospital. And what he'd actually designed was what we call the House of Transformation, which is the house I'm in right now, where we literally have healing activities happening 24/7. We have, you know, events happening in the house. You know, we have people coming in and out of the house all the time to receive, you know, healing and growth, and to learn how to heal and grow as entrepreneurs and so forth. So, you know, he basically told me, Dad, you got to go back to work because you're unhappy. And when he told me that, I realized, all right, you know, it's time to go back to work.
So your son, the person who grounds you, is also the person who's like, Dad, it's time. You got to go do something else.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's time. And I work with some entrepreneurs that, you know, they also go deep into their healing journey, especially for those of us that had the privilege to take that type of time and invest that type of time into it. And, you know, the strategy works, and then all of a sudden it will stop working once you've gotten everything you can out of the strategy. And then you have to have a new strategy. Now my strategy is two things. I optimize my productivity and my generosity. And the balance between my productivity and generosity is how I'm able to enjoy life to its fullest. I don't sacrifice time with my son. I don't buy into the myth that I need to work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. I think that's just nonsense. You know, if you're a highly skilled, highly talented person, you can attract highly skilled and highly talented people, and you don't need to work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week to be able to manifest, you know, your soul's calling. There's a lot of entrepreneurs that I know that prescribe that. And, you know, that is not the way. You know, I do work 17 hours a day, 7 days a week, but I probably spend 6 hours of that each day working on myself. And then on Saturdays and Sundays, I spend 24 hours of that enjoying myself. And as a result of that, I show up to my work with great energy, excitement, enthusiasm, and a high level of conviction, and a great deal of satisfaction and happiness. And that radiates and attracts people that vibe with that. And so we do great work, more so than we ever did when I prescribed to the idea that I should work myself to death.
Will Altar Call be a greater financial success than Vaisalas?
It'll be tenfold wow. That of Vaisalas, if not more.
Okay, you guys heard it here. The prediction's been done. Ryan, I want to thank you for being on the show. I've been talking to Ryan Blair. He's an author, a serial entrepreneur, a philanthropist, probably most importantly, a dad. He's also written the best-selling book, Nothing to Lose, Everything to Gain, How I Went from Gang Member to Multimillionaire Entrepreneur, and also Rock Bottom to Rock Star. Thank you for being my guest. Where can people go to find more about you?
If you just go to altercall.com, it's altercall.com. Or you can catch me on Instagram. I'm in the DMs. It's me. I'm at Real Ryan Blair on Instagram.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you, Chris. I'm Ryan Blair, and you are listening to The Future.
Thanks for joining us this time. If you haven't already, subscribe to our show on your favorite podcasting app and get a new insightful episode from us every week. The Future Podcast is hosted by Chris Doe and produced by me, Greg Gunn. Thank you to Anthony Barrow for editing and mixing this episode. And thank you to Adam Sanborn for our intro music. If you enjoyed this episode, then do us a favor by rating and reviewing our show on Apple Podcasts. It'll help us grow the show and make future episodes that much better. Have a question for Chris or me? Head over to thefuture.com/heychris and ask away. We read every submission, and we just might answer yours in a later episode. If you'd like to support the show and invest in yourself while you're at it, visit thefuture.com. You'll find video courses, digital products, and a bunch of helpful resources about design and creative business. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.